Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Grayscale Gorilla Podcast. I hope you're having a wonderful Monday or whatever day you're listening to this. As always, we have Chad Ashley here with us today.
Hey, everybody.
And Chris Schmidt.
Hello, hello.
Coming in from Chicago. I'm coming in from Michigan. Hope you guys' weekend was wonderful. And we are here to talk about motion design, Cinema 4D, 3D news. Man, we get into everything on this show lately.
Yep.
Mattresses.
Mattresses, extended conversations about mattresses. Best
hey, man,
podcast.
We know what you guys want to hear. We know what you're thinking about.
Well, let's get into maybe a little bit of news at first, and we can see where the show goes. What's been going around 3D world these days?
Oh boy. Well, the render competition, I guess you'd call it, is
the render wars.
The render wars, yeah. Thank you. Continues
the render
to grow.
Wars of 2016.
I can now kind of sort of talk about Redshift, which is currently in alpha, I believe. Still, maybe it's beta now. I can't remember which one for Cinema 4D, and it's looking pretty darn cool. I think a lot of people are going to dig that. So look for more on that stuff.
So is there anything you could share? Like, because I don't actually know a ton
about
Redshift.
Elevator pitch. Is this like Octane?
So
is it Arnold?
Imagine like Octane type speeds. It's biased. So what that means is that it cheats. Okay, so it cheats in ways that you're gonna benefit from in a production. Whereas Octane is like, I'm reality. I'm just gonna show it to you how it should be in the real world. Take it or leave it. Redshift kind of differs as it says, we know you're in production. We know that not everything has to be physically accurate. It just needs to look right, and you need to be able to deliver on time. So they've made a biased renderer that works off of the GPU. Now, the main difference is that it actually feels a little bit more like if you've ever used V-Ray or maybe physical, in that you have two different, you have a primary and a secondary GI method. So you have like a primary would be brute force, and the secondary might be like a light cache kind of thing, very similar to physical or V-Ray. So you've got that sort of going for it. It is ridiculously fast, I will say that, if you have multiple GPU cards like I do. It's still in its early stages in terms of getting everything working the way that it does in the Maya version and the Houdini version and whatnot. But it's looking really good. It's definitely going to be giving Octane a run for its money. I think it's for a different kind of artist. I think Redshift is more skewed towards the production heavy artist that needs to deliver a lot of things very quickly, a lot of elements, a lot of passes, that sort of thing. So yeah, it's going to be exciting. Look for more on that as it becomes more public.
Do they have dates or anything? I know you can't share a ton, but do they have any dates? Or
I don't know if they have any dates, and at least they haven't shared anything publicly. But it's very close. From what I've been playing with, it feels pretty darn complete. I mean, there's a few things that are still kind of being worked out. They're also really good about getting back to people, like their forum. If you're a customer, they're really quick to get back to you. The developer is a really cool guy. He's very personable. He's really wants it to be good, and he wants it to be, you know, something that people enjoy using. So there's that going for it, which, I mean, you could say that about all of them. I think probably Arnold has a developer that's just from another world. Like, he's so insanely good. I'll give him a shout out, Peter Horvath, if you're out there listening, you rock. So like, to me, like, it's so much of what makes good software is the people behind it. And if they're good, then you know that it's going to be good. So I'm confident that they're gonna be something to reckon with when it comes out, for sure.
Wow, this will be fun. I mean, there's a lot happening right now in this world.
It's crazy, dude. Like, I mean, it's kind of like, after a while, I dive into each one. Like, I'm in maybe three different renderers in the course of one day, and sometimes my brain just like forgets where I'm at, and I'm like, wait, can I even do that in here? So It's weird, man. I feel like I'm at the UN, and I'm like one of those guys translating, you know? And there's like 10 languages coming through, and I have to like somehow, it, you know, translate them all. It's kind of crazy, but...
Well, I will say it was easier than I thought to start to learn a new renderer. Mm-hmm. As I'm playing with Arnold, and it was less of a like total refresh than I thought. It's kind of like what everyone tells me is the experience of like switching to different 3D platforms, where it's like it's still like a lot of your knowledge transfers. Like your mm-hmm. brain doesn't erase. It's just a slightly different interface and tool and all that stuff. So what was really fun about Arnold was like getting up and running in basic, like, you know, from your video that you did. I guess we should link that up. Getting started, mm-hmm. started with Arnold. Even after that 1 hour long video tutorial, basically you gave me, I'm like, I can get into quite a lot with Arnold and start getting my feet dirty, I guess. So, yeah, it'll be really exciting when people have like 10 of these to choose from and go like, I don't know, I guess maybe I'll get the demo of all of them and see what happens. What else been going on? They got, we have a ton of stuff going on. You know what was really interesting on Friday, toward the end of the day on Friday, our like internal Slack channel, sometimes people will post a link and we'll all start talking. There was a big discussion about VR. And mm-hmm. I know a lot of our customers and, you know, people that listen to the show are also interested in this big VR layout. Are you guys into VR? Like, you guys have any setups at your house?
I have a setup. Hold on.
Well, I gotta give a shout out to Ivan, the former intern, because he's like obsessed with VR. He's been the one arguing. Oh, there you go.
Oh, wow. Cinema 4D.
This is the extent of my VR right now.
Yeah. Nice. At the booths recently at some of the trade shows, Cinema 4D, Maxon have been giving out the, is it Google Cardboard? Is that right?
Yes.
So it's the Google Cardboard, for those of you listening and not watching, with some Maxon logos as eyeballs, which is kind of fun.
Wait. I know we're getting into the specifics of VR, but I've just by going to Maxon events, I've gotten several of those boxes, but mm-hmm. I don't have a use for it because I don't use the Google Glass or any of that. So I dismantle them and I take out the plastic lenses, and you can hold them in your hand and stack multiple ones and get a very strong magnifying glass or even microscope thing going, and you can hold it up to things and you see little,
it's
very tiny.
Are you burning ants?
No.
Chris?
I've done that in the past, but not in a long time. But you can zoom up on like anything. You can look at the texture on like your MacBook, and you're like, whoa, look at all the grain and all these super crazy detail. It's neat.
I love Chris. I love how Chris is totally not using the VR. Is
nope.
Like,
that's set up like, for my opinion on it. Yeah,
that's amazing. Yeah, I mean, I used this when I got home from, I don't remember if I got it from Seagraph or from NAB, or I think they gave them out of both. But I downloaded a couple of things on it, and then I had my kids play with it, and they were like super into it. Like it just like was amazing to them. And so I think it's definitely, you've got the entry level stuff, the Cardboard, and then you've got like the more, I guess you would call it prosumer grade stuff, like the Oculus. And I forgive me, I'm not an expert. I'm not Ivan.
No, none of us are.
Yeah,
Ivan, we should say that Ivan knows. Yeah. We should get him.
Let's preface this that we are not VR experts in any shape or form. So, you know, if we say something wrong, just remember that. The idea of the prosumer stuff, like the I guess it's the Oculus or the Vive, or I guess that might even be considered more high-end than most, and then the PlayStation 1 that's coming out and all that sort of thing. I think that stuff is cool, and I was having this discussion with Ivan, but I think that, in my opinion, and feel free to disagree with me on this, I think it's going to be all about your phone. I think you're going to want to use your phone to do VR and not buy some crazy contraption that you have to plug into a computer, or you have to plug into this or that. And the reason that I think that is because people are so entrenched in their phones right now. They just are constantly looking at their phones, especially me. I'm always looking at my phone. That it is such a natural step to just be like, pop, put it in a headset. Here I am in my phone, and now I can answer calls. I can text someone. I could do this. I could do that. It's a natural extension, I think, of that ecosystem. It's just a matter of the phones getting fast enough and powerful enough to kind of withstand that fully immersive kind of stuff.
I'm curious if what direction that can go, because I know the big news and the reason a lot of people are talking right now is they just announced the PlayStation Pro, which is essentially the PlayStation 4.5. So we're half a generation through this current generation of PlayStation. I think they come with the VR headset, and it comes with like a faster processor, because the current processor on it couldn't handle the dual rendering of the displays the way mm-hmm. they wanted it to. So right there, if the PlayStation 4 isn't powerful enough to do it, I'm picturing how well a phone can do it. And here's my opinion on everything. Well, first of all, I had an Oculus in my hands within a week of the very first one shipping, because I had a friend who thought it was super cool, and they ordered it, and they got it, and they're like, I got this thing, and you guys do computer things. I don't know what to do with this. And he gave it to us. So, like, the very first demos ever that existed, like, I had it in, like, the first week, and we all tried it on. We were wearing it. It's like, oh, that's neat. And then it's, like, the last time I touched VR. Like, I don't get it, for one. And, well, here's the thing. Is, like, I'm waiting for the killer app. I'm waiting for the thing where it was built for VR. It can only be done in VR. It's amazing in VR.
Well,
and it's an experience that you couldn't do any other way. And here's the thing, just for my general opinion, is nobody is going to develop for the platform until there's a big user base or it's accepted kind of across all the boards. But nobody's going to really support the hardware end of it until there's a user base and software that people want to get into it. So maybe the PlayStation can be a little tipping point here if it's really supported. But even that, I feel like it's like half support. So if you go and you make a video game and you're like, oh, it's also supported on VR, whatever the platform, mm-hmm. it's supported on VR, that means you're just wearing the monitor on your head and maybe you can turn and look left and right. Like, that is not what I'm talking about. It has to have been built and only usable in VR to be a killer VR application. And it's a chicken and the egg kind of thing. Like, they're not going to make the hardware, and everybody's not going to have the hardware in their house until there's a killer app. And
yes,
nobody's going to make
will.
The killer app until everybody has the hardware. So maybe PlayStation can do this, but I just don't see it ever. I just don't see this being able to happen. And everybody looks silly wearing the goggles.
That's true. I will agree. No one has taken a picture. I will challenge the world to show me a picture with somebody wearing VR goggles that doesn't look like a complete weirdo. It does not exist.
I was just at a party yesterday, and he had the PlayStation 1 out, and it is absolutely ridiculous to actually be in a party. That's really the weird part. Is like,
oh, yeah.
There's a group of 15 other people around, and there's this person isolated in a chair in the middle.
Going.
Looking around. And
bumping into walls.
Yeah, it was. I see where you're coming from, Chad, where it's like, I think eventually, yeah, phone, awesome. And I think even better than a phone is some sort of like literal glasses I could put on. Like, I would much rather do that.
Well, yeah, I mean.
Then like I'd rather
the
like the white earbuds. I want the VR version of the white earbuds, and I think a lot more people will jump on that. I mean, I know that's pretty far out, but right now it's yeah. I don't know. I'm kind of with you, Chris, where it's hard to find the right thing right now. Like,
I think
what is it for?
I think you make the price of entry like. The Google Cardboard kind of thing. Like that's that mentality I think is what's going to win here, because it's a low price of entry and you don't feel like, oh, I'm going to get this, the Sony one. And then in a year from now, it's going to be completely obsolete. Like you're going to be really bummed. So that's going to keep you from like maybe investing in that tech. Whereas like if I can spend $40 on a nice version of the Cardboard, like whatever this is, And I don't feel bad if it changes, or maybe it change, you know, like it's whatever, you know. But for me, I don't think the quality is as much of an issue as I think a lot of people in our industry, a lot of our friends are saying, oh, well, you don't get the quality. Well, let's just face it. The majority of the people in the world do not care that much right. about the quality. They would just care about the experience. So, like, if I gave these to – like, I gave them to my kids, you know, put them – and they're, you know, tweens, and they're not children, but they also know good from bad. They put it on. It was, like, coming off of my phone, which is a pretty decent display. It's like a UHD display phone. And they were completely entranced with it. They didn't care that the pixel count wasn't, like, crazy and the refresh rate wasn't, like, completely perfect. And I think that's the world – the world needs that low entry point into VR to kind of get on board with it. And I think that a lot of it is probably going to come not just from games, which will definitely be a big part of it and a thing to drive the higher end stuff forward. Mm-hmm. But the social aspect, I think, is what's more important for like the everyday user. So like if right now you've got millions and millions of kids, teenagers, whatnot across the country FaceTiming each other at night, like pretty much constantly FaceTiming their friends, that's going to change into something with this. And maybe they're all in a room like they're trying to do with I think Facebook debuted some sort of like meeting
that
space.
Demo was really compelling.
Oh, yeah, I think that's where I see it kind of going, is like people hanging out, people doing, it's better than FaceTime, you know, like that kind of thing.
Well, what we're doing right now too, for people that are watching this, we're all in a chat room, we all have our headphones on, we're all staring at the same screen. And anytime, you know, we want to do this and share a document or watch a video together or any of those things, it's this really, honestly, clunky process of, like, we're all sharing the same link. We're all looking at the same document, whatever. But imagine if we were doing that Facebook demo right now. Like, we could literally, like, present a video to show or mm-hmm. to add, you know, this note to the show notes or whatever. Like, in a room, I think that might drive it a lot quicker to scale, to kind of work out some of the bugs, which is all this sure. business stuff. Like, well, as people work yeah, from their living rooms, where, I mean, we're all in different cities basically right now, all working together on similar projects, all in a chat room right now, kind of like talking. And I think that'll really drive the tech.
That would be cool. I mean, and that could be, I haven't seen this demo you're talking about. We'll have to link it, but that could be the killer app I'm talking about, where people just are going to start using it. They don't care if they look goofy.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's an interesting point, because almost until recently, I think a lot of VR was alienating people. You know, like, it's you in this world, and you're going to experience this game, this film, this whatever. And mainly because it's really, really computationally expensive to have two people in the same space, in that quality of space, at the same time. Like, that's a lot. And, you know, I'm sure Ivan or somebody will yell at me in the comments if this is wrong, but it's really hard. So, but, like, to me, like, if they thought about it that way, and, like, let's think about this as a way not to, like, isolate a person in a space. Let's think about it as a way to, like, bring people together socially. Then I think you're going to get more people interested in it, because then it becomes like the new iMessage or the new whatever, where people are like, oh, you have to get in here because that's where we're all talking about this thing. And then you're like, oh, well, how do I do it? Well, you got to go spend $40 on these glasses, and oh, okay, I'll go do that. And that's a lot more compelling than like, I'm going to have to buy a $500 piece of gear that's going to be outdated in a year, and like nobody else is going to be able to play with me, and like it's kind of isolating and depressing.
What do you do with video games with the younger brother that wants to play, but you just give them the second controller and tell them that they're playing? What's the
that only works for a little while? They grow out of that quick.
They grow out of that fast. But what's the VR version of that? Is it like soup ladles, or what do you put on their head? You know.
You just put a hat over their face.
Well, here you go.
Is it not working?
Oh, you try unplugging it. They just have it back in.
They just have your previous phone, like, under a hat.
just laser lights in a baseball hat. I'm in it.
Their eyeballs are completely fried.
That's what I really want there to be some kick-ass augmented reality. Like, there's all those, like, proof of concept ones where it's like you see, like, the path draw out in front of you for a map, or billboards changing, or mm-hmm. or a phone call and it's off to the side. When that gets figured out and we can process it and it can track the real world in a good way, like that, that's a good bit of future tech right there.
That's actually, you know, I feel like that's a good, like a Google Glass kind of a thing, because then you're like,
isn't Google Glass like officially canceled right now?
I'm not like, it's got to be something like that where you're wearing it like glasses so that you can, you know, see through it.
Or they got to get it working directly into your brain.
We're
in the very, 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 very early stages of that.
I'm waiting for the chips, guys. I will be one of the first to sign up and get the implant. Because I'm already guy, like, I do a lot of, you know, brainstorming and idea kind of stuff at a bar. It's just my thing that I do. I go over at the end of the day, get a beer, relax, go through all these things in my mind, and start brainstorming. And I always have my white earbuds in, so I'm already that level of disconnected from, like, the real world, like, trying to drown out the, like, Tigers game or whatever. I'm sitting there sketching, so I might as well have, like, some glasses that, like, also add some secondary crap to like, remove me from the world. I think so many places are going to be like that soon. It already is, right? Like, everybody sits down, they put in, they at least pull out their phone and they just stare at it for 2 hours. I think this VR thing is going to go really crazy with that. To me, I like it. It's like everyone's going to be able to hang out wherever they want, wherever they are. I think it's kind of cool.
It's interesting. I'm all about that, the idea of this kind of tech. Like, I'm always reading up on these kind of things, and I've got books on it. And there's a graphic novel called Transmetropolitan, which is like super in the future, and everybody can like body mod and virtual everything. It's just like I'm all about that. It just has to get there.
Oh man.
Yeah, I don't know if I would go so far as letting anybody plug into my brain, but. I don't know.
But once everybody else is doing better than you and storing things and instantly communicating, and
I mean, I guess I would.
Where's Chad?
Exactly. Yep. I'm like Lawnmower Man.
He's plugging in his goggles. People still do that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm all for like there's those things that you can. I mean, I've seen. They can tap into your. They're curing blindness. They're curing all this crazy stuff by, like, you know, getting all into the brain and whatnot. Like, it's probably not that far away, as far as like being able to generate imagery or, you know, connect your brain and maybe being able to. Can't you like draw with your brain like now? Like something. I read somewhere that you could control. With something on your head,
like a cursor.
Yeah, you can like control a cursor or something.
That's all. Like, if they can feed you imagery and you could move a cursor with a thought, that's all you need.
And we're in.
You just get nosebleeds constantly.
Yeah.
Then we just shut this whole thing down. See ya. See ya on the internet. Well, we'll have to maybe have somebody that actually knows what the heck they're talking about on here about this, because I think we're all in agreement. Like. It's really interesting stuff to keep up with, or at least keep up with barely the way that we are. But
I feel like we might be on Mars before we have like proper VR.
Maybe. Okay. Maybe.
There's a timeline for Mars right now. there isn't for VR.
That's true. I don't know. Why would you want to go to Mars, though? Like, isn't it like just a desolate wasteland?
It's exploring. It's a sense of exploration. I can appreciate that, even if I don't necessarily want to go. Plus, Elon Musk said you could come back again. So,
how long would that take? That got to be a long time, right?
A few years there, a few years back.
No. It's significantly less. I mean, right now it would take 6 months, and he's proposing advances that would make it like just like a month or two.
Imagine being a month in coach.
It's faster.
Like you don't have enough money for the business class or the first class ticket.
That was one of the questions, was like, could you come back again? He's like, the rocket is flying back. If you want to get on it, like, sure. Like, it's coming back anyway.
I love that. I guess if your hand was stamped, I guess you could go back.
Yep.
your hand, you get the.
It's like so not technical. Yeah, I guess you could come back if you want. Just jump on. I mean, it's going to be leaving at this time, though. You better be there.
Just don't wash your hands too many times.
Bus is leaving. Yeah.
Yeah. Jeez, give me a break. That's
but
crazy.
I mean, you'd probably have to pay full price to get back to Mars again.
What if you got there and you didn't?
Don't forget your wallet.
What if you got there and you didn't like anybody that was there?
That'd be the worst.
That'd be the worst, man. Like, I just spent 6 months getting here, and I can't go outside, and now I'm with a bunch of people I don't like.
I feel like that's like most people's experience with becoming a lawyer. Like, they know they want to do it.
And being a lawyer is like going to Mars.
Yeah, they're like, I think that'd be really fun. Like, I could defend the people, and I could do this, and then they go to school for like all this time and like all these studying, and they go through the whole thing, and they pass the bar, and then they show up to work, and they're like, I got to work with these people.
I got to rethink this.
Oh no! I thought it'd be like a TV show.
Nope.
Mars, I love you, lawyers. I'm sorry. I have some of my best friends are lawyers.
Yeah.
All right. Here's what I'm thinking. Chad, you had that article too that you mentioned before the show.
Oh yeah. Here's some news that we actually know about, or we've actually experienced in some way. An article today was published, and if you're listening to this later, then I guess you'll just have to look at it in the link. But it's posted on cartoonbrew.com, and it's a story about ILM's a couple of artists that used to work at ILM during the Jurassic Park days, and how they were kind of this rebel group. They were a little bit, rambunctious couple guys. And
real upstarts.
Yeah, real upstarts that, you know, just, you know, had fun with it. And this was, you know, back in the day, when you read this article, you'll learn a little bit more about it. I'm not going to spoil it too much for you. But at that time, there wasn't, like, fully departmentalized visual effects. So they didn't have, like, you know, you weren't just like a small piece in the puzzle that got that passed it off to the next person. You were kind of in control of your shot. That meant everything from tracking to, you know, animation, all that sort of stuff. So during Jurassic Park, that's kind of how, you know, that came about. They had these really talented people that would just kind of own their shots. And so the article kind of talks about that, talks a little bit about what these guys have done since then. And it's kind of an interesting little insight into that time period, which I think a lot of people, if you're like me, like watched Jurassic Park, the first one, and were like blown away. And like, it's one of the things that like got you interested in this business maybe.
Oh yeah.
So reading that article was kind of cool to see like how these, they didn't really know what they were doing, and they were just kind of making it up as they went along. And just trying things that were like completely nobody had ever thought to try. And I think that what I take away from the article is that maybe somehow some studios are losing a little bit of that scrappiness because they're not letting people own a shot from beginning to end. Everything has to be so compartmentalized to get these incredible amount of shots done, mm-hmm. which is fine and great. And like, you see shows that are, you know, 1,200, 3,000 shots in a movie. And like that couldn't have been done back then, obviously, because if you had one person owning a shot, you'd have to have thousands and thousands of people working on a show. So obviously they had to change the business to be able to do these kinds of films. But it is kind of cool when you're forced to like figure out everything on a shot, you're going to approach it differently and not be like, oh, the effects guys will worry about that, or the rigging guys will worry about that. But taking a more generalist approach, I think, is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I've always liked that idea in general. It's what drew me to commercial work, I think, in the first place. When I started learning about filmmaking, I thought I wanted to go into film and make Jurassic Park and Terminator. I learned those things, which was you don't really own a shot. You do this one thing, or you specialize in this one bit. And I've always liked the idea of like the performance of an entire thing. Like I want to like the way that I'm obsessed with one man bands more than I am like a group making music, right? Like this one person walked on stage and made it, and you got to see the whole process. And there's something about that that drew me to commercial work that almost repelled me from filmmaking because of that. I don't know, like maybe people are still drawn to film because they like being that. Like maybe they want to be a part of a team. Mm-hmm. But it'd be interesting to see like what people's expectations are when they get into filmmaking and what they actually want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like, did you got into this stuff Chad because of filmmaking.
Yeah, well,
originally.
I came around the back into this industry through filmmaking and traditional animation because, you know, that's what I wanted to do, and then ended up doing this. And like then it's weird, like, because I was doing filmmaking in college and then got out of college, started doing 3D, and then when I worked at DK, I got back into filmmaking and was doing directing commercials, live action commercials. And it was like this weird full circle thing. And the two people that they interview in this article kind of went through the same thing. They ended up kind of moving into live action from 3D, which is a definite it's not for everybody, as they say in the article. You kind of have to want to do that. It's not just going to fall into your lap. It's similar in a lot of ways and different in even more ways. But yeah, it's an interesting kind of thing, because what we do a lot of the times, some people will get into 3D from, well, there's really only a couple of ways. Like, you're either ArcViz, you know, working on spaces and it interests you and you start to get more into 3D. Filmmaking, you want to do visual effects and like really amp up your filmmaking. Maybe you're an animator, like super into, you know, animation. That's how you get into 3D. There's all these like ways of getting into 3D. I do feel like I'm not seeing as, maybe they are out there, I just don't see them, but I see a lot more people coming into 3D from different areas, design, animation, whatnot. Not as many coming in from filmmaking, I think, mainly because, and this is just my opinion, don't know if this is true or not, but it feels like now filmmaking is so easy to do. Like, when I was in school, you had to, like, good cameras were really expensive and they were not easy to get, and you couldn't, we were shooting on Bolexes, you know, on 16 millimeter film. You had to develop the film, you had to edit by hand. It was just like this messy process that everybody, you had to really want it to do it well. You had to really, really want it. And now everybody's phone can shoot 4K and the price of entry is so low. I can go to Best Buy and for under $500, I'll have a camera that'll shoot amazing stuff. And
yeah, but your distinction is that it's easier to do, not the art of it, but like the availability of the technology.
Yeah, the availability of the technology. So that makes it really easy to be a filmmaker and kind of like hone those skills. But if you were like me, maybe, you know, in the 90s or whatnot, and you were frustrated that you wanted the control that you couldn't get on a film set because you needed this person to get that camera and that person to hold that light. And, you know, it was like this huge process, that 3D was a way for filmmakers like me to do whatever I wanted at all and have full control over everything. And that was the appeal initially of 3D for a filmmaker like me, because I could tell stories in an environment that I didn't need like a million people and a million things and a lot of money. And well, you needed a lot of money, but you could work somewhere that had the gear. That's a whole other talk. But
well, Chad, you've done this, and actually, now that I think about it, Chris, you've done it too. So it'd be nice to hear from both of you guys. You've worked on projects where you had full control from start to finish of what it looked like and what it was, and basically built every part of the scene from scratch and had full control of it. You've also both worked in teams where you had a smaller part in the process, but were able to build something that you wouldn't have been able to build on your own. So the question is, like, what do you guys pull more like creative fulfillment out of, knowing that you've done both of those things? And Chris, I'm thinking about your Dumb and Dumber titles that you worked on. You know, do you have a thought about that? Like, what was that like working in a larger team, and was it fulfilling creatively to like what you're into?
It's a tough call there, because I definitely can compartmentalize it, where I can appreciate it for the part that I did, and I think in a larger production, you can really feel like you lost it. I'm just picturing somebody working at Pixar, like I, this could be false, but I feel like the rock stars of 3D are the 3D animators, because they are the ones who are like, they're creating a performance, and you can now cause emotion. You can pull emotions out of people, you know, your viewers. So the person doing lighting, that's so much more abstracted. The person doing FX work, that's so much more abstracted. So you don't get that kind of direct one-to-one. And rockstar is such a relative term here, because, you know, nobody's going up and not, there's not many people going and getting their their Emmy and whatnot for the performance of a particular character in a thing because they animated it. Like, there's not enough appreciation
there
of that kind
be.
Of thing.
There should be.
No, yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, okay, Tom Hanks did a great job doing voice acting for it, but the performance was somebody behind a computer. But I don't know. It's definitely gone both ways where I like having ownership from beginning to end. But then when I – like the Dumb and Dumber one, like that was a technical challenge to me where it's like, okay, I want to really figure out the soft bodies and get the things layered up and figure out the timing. And then, you know, I was working with Aaron Becker on that, and he's determining like, oh, I want the timing to be more, I want it to be less, I want it to be less squishy, or everything has to settle quicker. So I felt less ownership over that, but I really felt like I get to nail the technical aspect of it. But and then even now working in Grayscale Gorilla stuff, like, you know, I like I'm pretty happy with my position with developing the products because I'm kind of conceptually coming up with things and prototyping and figuring out where the things go. But then if I were to just, you know, and then this often gets passed down to the brothers, Danny and Johnny, doing the coding. And I would feel like I would have less ownership of that because it's just like, oh, I want you to turn A into B. And then you do that. Where it's almost like the creative act is deciding to turn A into B. So it's a really tough push and pull there. Where can you feel ownership? And then where can you feel like you, like that aspect of it is yours. So Dumb and Dumber, right. I had ownership over an aspect.
Yeah, I think that for where I stand on it is like I love talented people, and anybody that knows me and like knows how I've built teams and stuff at the different places that I've worked, I like people that elevate my work, and like I want them to blow me away and like make my stuff look terrible because that just is going to make me try harder, and I love that. I love team-based environments. I've always loved working in a team, mainly because there's just certain things that I recognize in myself that I'm just not as good at, and I don't have a particular interest in trying to be mediocre at everything. I'd rather try to focus on a few things that I like and that I know I can excel in, and then find people that complement that and build a team off of that. And when I was finishing up at DK, like we had a really killer team of 3D artists, and I was barely even on the box anymore because these guys were so good that my job was then to just kind of play conductor and like make sure all the pieces were moving in sync and getting the best quality work out of each person that I possibly could. And that meant, you know, trying to inspire them to learn new things or try different techniques or jumping in with something that I knew that I learned years ago or whatnot. Always wanting to make sure they felt like they had ownership of whatever area, like what Chris was saying, like trying to make sure that everybody has ownership over something so that at the end of the day, they don't feel like it was all just, you know, one thread of a shirt that they contributed to, that they actually made a sleeve or they made the collar, you know what I mean? So that they could step back at the end of the process and be like, it was my job to make sure that sleeve was there. That's the weirdest analogy ever, but you get what I'm saying. Like that, it's important as a CD to make sure that everybody on the team feels like they're contributing something, because you're going to get better work out of them. And then there's also accountability, which is a very important part of that, which is if it doesn't look right or it's not working, that you can't just say, well, you know, it's all of our faults, right? No, you were in charge of the sleeve. That sleeve is not working. We got to fix it. So it's kind of like this double-edged sword, I guess, where you are going to get that that satisfaction of knowing that you contributed a significant part to a project, but it also means that you're responsible, and that's a really important lesson for, I think, people to learn.
Yeah, I actually, going into this talk, I was mostly thinking that I have this personality where I want all this, I always need it my way or something, and actually, as you guys describe it, some of the things that I'm most proud of are when there's so much other people helping and involving what they do best that I can be a part of a bigger team. I'm thinking of some digital kitchen projects I was a part of. I was thinking of Half Res, even the ability to put on a show like that. I can't do it by myself. And those things are really creatively rewarding because it all comes together. Like, I'm actually thinking of musicals right now for some reason, because I think musicals to me are probably like the most emotional I get ever is at a musical. And I try to think about why that is. And I think it's because
I cannot believe I just heard that. I'm going to let you go ahead, but I'm just going to, I'm okay.
Yeah. No, this is a little insight to my weird brain, but wow. There is something about a musical. I already got chills. Okay. There's something about a musical that is a group of people that are doing something that is specifically what they love to do. Like, they went way out of their way to do something that is probably some of their family members are like, really, you want to go do anything? I mean, I'm talking about people doing the lighting, doing the costume design, people doing the orchestra, people designing the sets, people acting, obviously, people producing, directing. Like, think about every job for that one thing is all built to, like, entertain a group of people for an hour and, like, put an emotion in front of them. And they always do. I think they're an amazing thing. You can't pre-record them. They're always done live. So now you have this group of people who they've, like, almost dedicated their life to doing this live event that they all coordinated themselves in this perfect way. The orchestra was created and timed just right, and the lighting was timed just right, and the music cues, and the curtain was open, like the popcorn was fresh, like every element of that entire thing, like, at least to my eyes, worked, and it created a story and an emotion and songs, and the person that wrote the song might not even be alive anymore, but they're singing this musical still. Like, there's this weird sense of, like, being a part of a group that I see in everyone's eyes at the end of a musical, that I'm like, I want that. Like, I want to be that, a part of something that important and big. That isn't, yeah, I mean, we don't have to go into, like, if musicals are important, because they are.
I don't know, man. I was so shocked when you said that, just because it's so random. But now I think I feel like I have a little bit, after your explanation, I can kind of dissect what you're saying a little bit. And it's that feeling of being a part of something a little bit bigger than you, and it's the camaraderie, it's the dedication, that really is what is appealing about working with a team. Now, it's different, I think, if you're, like, what you're describing is an awesome small team that's tackling, you know, cool shit and, like, is happy doing what they're doing. I'm not sure how that translates to a larger studio. I've never worked at a larger studio that has, like, you know, buildings across the campus that have, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what that's like. But I can relate to what you just said, although I'm not a big musical fan, but I do take away, I'm understanding what you're saying. For me, it's more like a band, like a rock band kind of mentality. I always saw my team at DK, even the 3D team, as like a band, because we were, you know, none of us were solo artists, and we could only be good if we played together. And that's how it felt to me. And it we had that kind of bond where you spend enough nights working late, you know, eating pizza, that you just kind of develop a bond with people. And that's something that, you know, is actually a good segue to another topic, which
but
is...
But I want to change off this
oh,
one.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Sorry. Sorry, Chris.
I was just going to say that I as soon as you said musical, I knew exactly where you're going with it, because I totally agree. And I've never been in the band or any of that kind of stuff. And, you know, I've worked on random projects. But at this year's Half Res, like, never before have I think it was, like, the first time I kind of felt this emotion this strongly, but it's exactly what you were describing. There's this moment at Half Res, because I feel like with Half Res, I'm the conductor. It's the one time where I'm like, I feel like at the end of the day, maybe I did like 10% of the work, but there's so many other parts moving all the way. You know, everything's happening and it's kind of out of my control now. And I'm trusting that everybody else contributed. And, you know, it's like, okay, I got a speaker and they know when they're going to speak, but I don't know.
Chris, are you okay? Chris is upside down.
I have no control over that now. They're going to speak, and what they have is what is going to be. And there's this moment when, because we had 150 people lined up outside waiting to get in the half res. And I ended up like on the moment, I was like recruiting people and grabbing people and being like, okay, you got to help me, like grab some tickets, go out. We're going to start signing people up outside to get them in the doors quicker. Otherwise, they're going to be doing this forever. And there's a moment when everybody got inside and everything was happening. And I finally went over to the bar to get my first drink. And I just kind of looked around and it was like, holy crap. Like, this is happening. Like I said, I didn't even have a drink yet. And I had like this grin just stuck on my face of like, it's happening. All these pieces are moving and I don't even have to do anything. And it's just going to continue. And like, there's hundreds of people showing up and you don't even have to, I don't know. It's just like this moment of like, wow, like all this lead up and now it's happening and it's going and people are showing up and people like it and they love it. And I don't know. It's just kind of like,
that's a good, that
overwhelming like that. And in the best way possible.
Well, for a lot of our audience too, to bring it to cinema and learning and these kind of things, I think early on in your career, you're kind of on your own, right? And the only things that you can build are things that you have access to. Now you could use plugins and stock footage and all these things to kind of like prop up parts of your knowledge that you don't know. But at the end, it's still like everything that comes out the other side is like under your control, every color, the render settings, like everything you did. And in some ways that's so like empowering. And in some ways it's so scary because you don't have anybody to fall back on. You have nobody to ask a question to sometimes. Like you have nobody to trust, even just to edit something the way that even, you know, I would pass off work at Digital Kitchen to an editor and they would do things even in an edit that I couldn't even comprehend because they were professional editors, right? Like mm-hmm. I wouldn't have even thought to do that. And when it comes back better than when you left it. And that is such a unique feeling that is very different than I think a lot of people's experience where they have full control, where they don't have a team.
Yeah.
But then I'm also torn because my personality is to disappear like off the grid for 48 hours and be in my own project, obsessed with it and just like heads down learning something. So I wonder if there's not a little bit of both where you need that time for yourself to understand what you're into and obsess over whatever that is, but then eventually opening yourself up to being a part of a group or to trying that side of your personality out to see if you work well in a team or you like that feeling. I wonder if there's something there.
Well, that goes. Well, I super appreciate both of those angles. And I think at different times, I think you almost want to be mixing it, like going back and forth between mm-hmm. those things. And I mean, I think there's plenty of people. I'm thinking of so many people we know in Chicago who, like, they leave school and they immediately get a job at a studio as an intern and then they get hired. And they were always kind of a cog in the system. And then they're like, okay, I'm done with this. I'm leaving. I'm going freelance. I want control. And then they've done it the other direction where, like, they're suddenly going from just being a small part of it to being everything, and that can be probably both amazing and terrifying at the same time. We're going you know, the direction you're talking about. Suddenly you're relinquishing control and you have to trust other people, which is a different kind of terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, Chad, you've seen both sides of this, you know, especially hiring a lot of people and seeing that. What do you think there's a right way to do that? Because I get this question a lot about specialty versus generalist, and specifically about should I become a freelancer out of school or should I go get a job? And I've always said, go get the job, go learn from other people, go be around them, go see how business is even made. Like, you know, go sit in some meetings and see how you don't want to have meetings at least, right? Like,
absolutely.
Go learn about it. Do you have like something that you would recommend for maybe some of our listeners out there that are starting off or in school or freelancing, or what have you seen?
Well, I mean, it's weird now. I think that a lot of it kind of comes down to where you live too, because if you're living near a major metropolitan area and you graduate from school and you want to do 3D for a living, then absolutely your best bet is to go find a studio that you can intern at and get your foot in the door and kind of work your way up and try to learn that business, because I think it's a little bit premature to be in school and say that I want to do rigging or I want to do lighting. That's all well and good, and you should definitely still maintain those skills, maybe grow them, but you'll get you're going to get in a professional environment, at least in the commercial world, and I can't speak for film, but you're going to get exposure to so many different things that you might find yourself falling in love with something that you never thought you'd fall in love with. And that is worth it, I think. And there's that part of it. There's the teamwork aspect of it. There's the camaraderie that you're going to get. Now, what's weird to me and what's kind of scary to me is, like, not a lot of people – there's a lot of people living near these major metropolitan areas, New York, Chicago, L.A., you know, wherever you want to say is, like, a major hub for this sort of work. But there's just as many people that don't live near these areas that are – don't have the same resources, they don't have the same studios that they can go work with. They end up kind of having to go the freelancer route because they can work remotely. And there's that whole side of the business that was kind of non-existent up until about 5 or 10 years ago.
Or they are a part of a studio, but they're like the one person. They are right. Like the designer or the 3D person or the like one creative in a group of others.
I've been that person too. When I worked at Optimus a long time ago, I was the only 3D person there and I was in charge of everything that had to do with 3D. And so that was like a trial by fire. So if a job came in that I didn't know how to do, I couldn't turn to my coworker and say, hey, let's think about ways to do this. I literally had to figure it out, which meant that you either got really good or you wanted to hang yourself in the closet. It was like you didn't have much of a choice. You either learn it or you don't. So, I mean, there's good things about that. But, I mean, to get back to your question about, like, finding that balance between working in a team environment and staying inspired as an individual artist, I think that that's incredibly important for people. And when I was managing a team of artists, I always tried to encourage them to explore things that they were interested in when we weren't really cranking on a job. So if they wanted to go do a deep dive in ZBrush for 2 weeks or a week and we could afford to do that, or maybe I would try to find ways to, like, always be pushing them towards something that they were interested in. Like, I would always constantly be like, so what are you, like, are you interested in this? And they'd be like, yeah, okay, well then I'm going to get you some DVDs and, like, try to push that. And any good CD is kind of paying attention to their team and is like, okay, what area is Chris interested in? Well, he's really into rigging, but he's also, when he's not rigging, I see him doing sculpting. So, hey, Chris, you want to take the sculpting class? You know, I think you might think it's fun. And then he'd hopefully be like, yeah, cool. So, you know, if you don't have a CD doing that, you have to do it for yourself. You have to, like, take that time and really dedicate it to whatever you find interesting. For me, I like to nerd out on rendering software, as you all know. So for me, I will take a part of my day. I give myself 30 minutes. I give myself 30 days to test software, and I don't come up for air for 30 days. No, I give myself 30 minutes every day. It's on my to-do list to beta test something for 30 minutes because that is fun for me. And so carve out that time in your day to dedicate towards R&D. If you're working with a giant team and you just need some me time, then carve that 30 minutes out to do something that just you are doing. If you have the opposite and you're like a one-man band and you just wish you had somebody to bounce something off of, then find someone. And in that 30 minutes a day, show them what you're working on. Get some feedback. Have a conversation. You do have to find the balance, otherwise you'll become stale or unhappy, and that's something that I think, you know, a lot of people — I'm going to talk forever on this subject — but a lot of people just need to recognize the patterns of unhappiness and figure out how to correct them before they become unhealthiness. And so what I mean by that is, like, if your day-to-day is not fulfilling, you're going to become unhappy, and you might not even know that you're doing it, but you start to, you know, become kind of irate and mean and just kind of not liking life. And then that can even start to transgress into you physically not being healthy. So being able to recognize these patterns in yourself and say, I need to balance my day more, I need to do this more, I need to do that more, is really a key to having a successful creative career. And I know you've talked about this, Nick, before.
Yeah, those are things I could, like musicals, I could talk about forever.
I learned something. If there's nothing that I learned from this podcast, is that Nick really likes musicals.
I really do. Listen, everyone likes musicals. If you like Disney movies, you're a fan of musicals.
I never thought about it that way. I guess when I think of a musical, I think of like, you know, West Side Story and like stuff like that. But I don't really necessarily think about animated films that have a lot of music in them. What's your favorite musical?
Oh, gosh. I finally saw Newsies.
Oh, my God.
Which was really good.
I saw
the movie, never loved the movie, but the stage production, the latest one, was really good.
Wait, are we talking about the actual play, or are we talking about the movie?
The play.
Okay, so that's not a musical, then. That's a play.
I mean, it's a musical. It's a musical play.
Is there a difference between the two?
I don't know. So. Well, a play doesn't have to have music, but if you're...
What's the definition?
I don't know. I grew up with a lot of musicals, which was cool, but I haven't been to enough of them. Nick, when I met your wife, then girlfriend, Marie, we were bonding over Sweeney Todd, and we were like singing the lyrics. Like, I grew up with like the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. Like, as a kid, I could sing all the words. Lots of those.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I kind of grew up with that kind of stuff, and Pete's Dragon and Willy Wonka and Chocolate Factory and all the Disney movies, of course. Like, that was the prime era of like Aladdin and Little Mermaid.
They were second golden age
musicals.
All musicals. And we would like, as a family, play like Disney musical songs around the house. That was like clean the house music for us. I may have this too, like just growing up in a roller rink and having like just that music played over and over again where you just have to like it. But I've always enjoyed it. I think it's always a little silly when people just start singing in movies. But
yes, but, it is very silly.
But on stage, when you're literally there to see it and you're seeing it live, it's always an amazing experience to me.
Like, I never got into musical movies, but like I like going to see a musical play. Like, that's it. Like, I saw probably the best one I saw was Wicked.
Wicked!
And I was like, wow, this is
so amazing.
This is crazy good. And but then like, you know, one will come on TV from, I don't know, like the 60s or something, and I'm just like, oh, I can't deal with this.
You got to,
like,
be in the right mood for the films.
I will say, though, that, like, Grease was one of my favorite movies when I was a kid.
There you go. See, you got Grease, you got Wizard of Oz, like, all these things. You start listening.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Maybe, my God, am I a fan of
you
musicals?
You might be. I'm telling you, everybody.
Dude, so many.
Because I'm not sure if I could, I don't know if I could say that, but maybe, yeah.
It's okay. Listen, it's okay. Everyone, just write in the comments, I am also a fan of musicals. It'll be fine. We'll all come together on this. We need a new Slack channel.
Yep.
We'll definitely get into this more. I think this idea of happiness, Chad, that you brought up is something really interesting about. In fact, if you guys are listening on YouTube, on iTunes, head over, let us know some of your thoughts, maybe some topics that you'd like us to talk about in this vein, because I think there's a lot there of making sure, you know, even with that lawyer joke earlier, like making sure you're going down the right path so that at the end of it, you are making decisions that generally make you happy, right? Like,
that is an episode we have to do.
That is a life.
We have to wrap this one up.
We do have to wrap this one up. That is a lifetime pursuit. And I think that's a really interesting topic for us to talk about, maybe our paths where we weren't or were more happy, and we'll save that for another time. But as always, folks, thank you for stopping by today. We're going to wrap this one up, and if you're still around, we have a fun week coming up on Grayscale Gorilla. We have a new tutorial coming out tomorrow from Chris. Chris, can you tease that one? What's that one all about?
Well, this is special because this is a tutorial that was lost in the archives.
Ooh.
So it's an unposted tutorial.
Lost and found.
Yeah, but it wasn't unposted because it was kind of mediocre. I really like this one, and somehow it never went up on the website. So I'll just tease it out that way.
That's how many tutorials we have, folks.
That's
a gem. We lose some. So this one's back from the dead. I like that. Recently we've been also remastering a lot of our tutorials to put on YouTube. We're going to have another one of those out on Thursday. And another episode of Ask GSG will be this Wednesday. at 1 p.m. Central. And if you are a subscriber to our SGSG series archives, which can be found on our training page, the Season 3, Episode 1 is up and ready to watch, including all the scene files. And that's where Chad was there with Chris making some really fun stuff. So check that out. And I think that's it for today. Any last bits before we take off?
Have a great week.
Yep. Bye-bye,
have an incredible Monday, everybody. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in another episode really soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.